afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. It's hard to believe, at least for me it's hard to believe, April 2nd of 2005 saw the passing from this earth of John Paul II, St. John Paul II. I'll tell you, I can remember it very well because I stayed on the air for I don't know how many hours straight. If you recall, there was almost what you would call a death watch. We knew that he was very, very ill, and people were speculating that he was soon to pass this earth. And so I just stayed on the air, keeping people abreast of what was going on. And during that time, I wish I could remember how many hours. I'd say at least 12 hours that I was on the air. I remember going over John Paul II's life. I had his encyclicals with me. And, you know, you're always trying to come up with things to say, if you have to fill time like that. And I was able to really get, in that kind of concentrated way, an overview of all that he had accomplished. I mean, published, for instance. That's the first place I begin. What has he written? And a tremendous amount of material. Then you look over his history, of course, the way he lived under the communists. The liberation of Poland. You can take a look at his championing of religious liberty. And I was blown away by how much he had actually accomplished. Now, some of you may have already felt that before his death, but it was in that concentrated period of roughly 12 hours of watching him die that it really hit me how remarkable and productive a man he had been. Well, I'm glad to say that longtime friend Patrick Novikowski has put together a wonderful book called 100 Ways John Paul II Has Changed the World. Patrick's a media relations professional living in Florida with his wife and five children. And Patrick, good to have you here. Thanks.
Be with you. It's been a few years.
It has been. I was just amazed at the scope of John Paul II's life. And you have 101 ways in which you changed the world here. It must have been, are these in any kind of order, or are they just 101? I mean, do you have a number one? Is like a countdown to number one?
Well, it's only 100 because his 100th birthday is coming up in May. So, you know, the trick thing is 101 because you're getting 100 plus a bonus more. But I only limited it to 100 because it's in commemoration of his 100th birthday, the centenary of his birth coming up next month.
That's right.
So the first 90 are not really in order. They're more of a flow. I started at 100 with religious liberty and kind of flowed from there and tried to make the book, at least those first 90, kind of be a cohesive theme. But I did rank the top 10. So okay. How this started was I met John Paul II 5 times prior to working for Legatus and Ave Maria University. Back when I worked for the National Shrine of Divine Mercy and the Marian Helpers in Stockbridge, met him 5 times. So I'd been giving a talk for some years about how I met him and how God used me to talk about John Paul II.
Yeah.
And then in that talk, I came up with his top 10 gifts to the world, top 10 gifts to the church. And I developed the ideas of what were really the nuggets of this 26-and-a-half-year papacy and ranked them in order. And I ran them by people like George Weigel and up scholars that had written about John Paul II, got their feedback and kind of sifted through to really get the best of John Paul. But when it came time to writing the book, there really wasn't enough there. But about a year ago, I recognized that his 100th birthday was coming up in May of 2020. So that's where the idea for 100 Ways He Changed the World came up.
Very good. You mentioned him five times you encountered him?
5 times, yeah.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that. What were the circumstances?
Well, so I was born and raised in Canada. I came to the United States in 1996, worked for U Magazine in Southern California for about a year. And then in the fall of 96, I moved to Stockbridge and worked for the Marian Helpers and the National Shrine of Divine Mercy. And I'd only been there a few months, and they had this employee raffle at Christmas. And the grand prize, this is back in the 90s when people didn't book their travel online. You went through a travel agent.
Mm-hmm.
The travel agent gave the grand prize, and the grand prize was a trip for two to Cancun, Mexico. And who won but the new kid? I was 27, and I won the trip to Cancun, and there are people working there 30 years looking at me and go, who's this new kid? He must have horseshoes. So I won the grand prize, but I didn't want to go to Cancun. I really, really desired to go to Rome because that's where our church was born, and that's where the Pope is. And so I the travel agent swapped it out. I went to Rome in the fall of 96. And the Marians, of course, have a house in Rome, and they said, well, I was a single man at the time, they said, well, why don't you stay at our house and do some work for us? I was associate editor of the Marian Helper magazine, and John Paul had asked the Marians to help the re-evangelization of Eastern Europe after the fall of communism. And so they sent this cub reporter out to the countries of Eastern Europe to write about their needs there. And my first stop was Rome. And they said, well, while you're in Rome, would you like to meet the Pope? And I said, well, do you need to ask? If there's a list, just put me on the list.
Yeah.
So I prayed to St. Therese because I have a great devotion to her. She went to Rome. She met the Pope. So I said, Therese, come on, put in a good word for me. You met the Pope. And lo and behold, I met John Paul II on October 1st, 1997, just happened to be her feast day.
Hmm.
And not only that, but the day before the prayer, the day the prayer was answered, the day the call came in, was September 30th, 1997, which was the centenary of her death.
Wow.
So I owe great debt to St. Therese for her intercession, for starting this whole thing off for me.
Yeah, I think it was William Temple who said, you know, when I pray, coincidences happen. When I don't pray, they don't happen. So,
amen.
these are clearly answers to prayer. What was his health like at that time when you met him?
In 97, he had broken his leg in 94, I think it was. And his physical health started to decline slowly over the years after that. The first time I met him, he looked tanned, he looked healthy, he walked without any assistance. I went back in 98, and he looked less well.
Yeah.
He looked tired.
I could see that.
So the first time that I met him in 97, he walked around the room, he greeted each person. 98, he leaned up against the door jamb. I saw him in Poland in 97 on a papal visit to Poland. He walked around pretty well, but by 2000, when I met him, he wasn't walking, he was in a chair. And each person kind of just came up to him individually. And the last time I saw him was actually almost 18 years ago today. Tomorrow, I think, 17th, so a couple of days from now, will be the 18th anniversary of the last time I saw him, which was on my honeymoon. He would bless newlyweds in
in
his general audience. And Michelle and I, my wife, we were married 11 days, married at Christ the King in Ann Arbor, right beside you. And we flew to Rome, and we got blessed by the Pope, and that began the rest of our lives.
You know, it's amazing how quickly time passes.
Amen.
I remember when you were single.
All right. It doesn't seem like that long ago.
No. Well, let's go over some of these, of the 100 ways in which John Paul II changed the world. Why don't you start with what we might be most surprised by?
Yeah, you know, most people don't know the impact he had on Africa. That was one that really, really surprised me. He went to about two-thirds to three-quarters of the countries in Africa. He visited. He had a special synod on Africa and mm-hmm. wrote a document, Ecclesia in Africa, which had a profound impact on the whole continent I really believe that, I mean, we see all the vocations coming out of Africa. We see how the church is alive in Africa. John Paul appointed Africans to some of the highest places in the Curia, in Rome. He expanded the College of Cardinals and included many Africans. And because of his travels, because of his passion for the faith and spreading that to Africa, I really believe that a lot of the fruit that's coming out of Africa today is because of his work. And so that's something that we didn't hear a lot about. We'd hear that, you know, he's on another trip because he made 104 trips outside of Italy, and traveled. Basically, if you would add up all of his air miles, he went around the world 30 times. So he was busy. And you know, we're very American-centric with the news that we get here, even from the Catholic press. But he had a profound impact on Africa, so that was one.
Did he appoint Cardinal Lorenzi?
I believe he did.
Wow. So he had a profound effect on Africa. Were there other geographic locations that he had special impact on?
Yeah, China and Russia are the two that he had a special attention to, I think. China, because, of course, the communist government in China and the restrictions on the spread of the faith and the practice of the faith. But every time, he had a great diplomatic outreach to China. And he also, every time he got close to China, he would broadcast messages into China through the radio from neighboring countries. A special message for the Chinese people. So, the diplomacy and the faith outreach and really supporting the faithful in China the best he could with the restrictions that were in place. Also with Russia, I think one of the greatest disappointments of his papacy was that he wasn't able to make an apostolic journey to Russia.
Right.
And it wasn't because the government didn't want him. Both Boris Yeltsin and, I forget his name, the other leader of Russia, Gorbachev, mm-hmm. both invited him to come to Russia. But he felt he couldn't if there was an impediment from the Russian Orthodox patriarch.
Right.
And so he held back making that trip out of wanting to really have good relationship with the Orthodox, because that was for him that was really important, the ecumenical outreach.
Yeah. He was hoping to restore full communion at the beginning
Absolutely,
of his papacy. Yeah, and he was unable to do that in spite of his outreach to the Russian Orthodox. Patrick, hold it there. Come back on the other side and continue looking at 100 ways John Paul II changed the world. Patrick Nowakowski, the author, my guest. I'm Al Cresta. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Looking over 100 ways John Paul II changed the world, my guest Patrick Nowakowski is the author of a book by that name, 100 Ways John Paul II Has Changed the World. And we've been just going over a few of them, the importance of his visits to Africa, the frustration he felt at not being able to get to Russia or to establish better ecumenical relations with the Russian Orthodox and the Eastern Orthodox in general. One of the things that people often talk about, Patrick, in terms of John Paul II's influence, has been his influence on vocations. And you hear people use a phrase, "We have a generation of John Paul II priests now." Was he very effective and successful at generating? Were the numbers good?
Yeah, I think so. I don't recall at this point the numbers, but I know that the men who call themselves JP2 priests were inspired by his passion for the faith, his commitment, his focus on Jesus Christ and the Eucharist and Our Lady, and his focus on vocations, his attention to priests. You know, they always say that if a bishop has a special focus on vocations and it's one of his passions, that God will provide the priests. He did that, especially, you know, under John Paul II. I think people saw a heroism in John Paul II. They saw that he was unafraid, that he was changing the world. I mean, if you lived in the 80s, beginning of the 1980s, everyone lived in fear of World War III, of bombs falling between the United States and the USSR. And by the end of the 80s, that was no longer a concern, primarily because of John Paul II and Ronald Reagan and their collaboration to bring down communism without a shot being fired. Communism, at least in Eastern Europe.
Coupled with that, he was an opponent of liberation theology too, and I remember the very famous picture of him chastising Father Ernesto Cardinal Martinez because of his involvement with the Sandinistas in Nicaragua.
That was on the tarmac in Nicaragua in the early 80s during one of his visits, and Father Ernesto just went to his reward with the Lord just like last month.
Yeah. What? Tell me a little bit about his opposition to liberation theology.
Well, liberation theology, and I'm no expert in it, but it sees Jesus as a conquering hero by force, and they mix it with Marxism and come up with this idea that it's okay to liberate a nation by force, by taking up arms against a tyrant. And John Paul was firmly against that. He saw the errors of communism and Marxism. He lived that experience with the communist takeover of Poland, and the Nazi takeover of Poland in his youth, and then the occupation of Poland by the communists in his later years as a priest and bishop and then pope. So he was very clear with priests, particularly in Latin America, that this was not the way to change the world. This was the way to continue conflict. And he was very firm with priests and bishops that, you know, this was the wrong direction.
Yeah. You also have a section here about his stand against socialism. So this was a very consistent approach. He did not like Marxist-centered social movements.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He saw socialism, again, as a flawed ideology. He had lived under socialism, you know, in Poland as a young man, and he understood how it corrupted the working class. He also pointed to Leo XIII as a prophetic voice. You know, the 100th anniversary of Leo's Rerum Novarum, John Paul reiterated the Catholic condemnation of socialism.
Right.
He just saw that it was a corruption of philosophy and theology, and particularly philosophy, and that it was just an errant philosophy.
Right. He also opposed unfettered capitalism too.
Absolutely.
So
you know,
it's always good to bring that up.
Ultimately, he saw economics as having to be in service to the human person,
right,
and the flourishing of the human person. And when there were the capitalism without control, without the common good being kept in mind, that was also an errant philosophy. And he was very clear, particularly with the United States, that because the United States was a world economic leader, it also needed to be a leader in freedom and economic justice.
Tell me, I've met a few people who served him as Swiss guards. I noticed that you have that here too, that he had special care for the Swiss Guards.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, I think you and I know some of the same people, Mary Lensler and
yes.
Widmer.
That's right. That's right. I guess we do.
Yeah. I mean, they were he was like a father to them. I mean, the Swiss Guard, people have to understand, these are young Catholic men who are most of them away from home for the first time, and many of them are deprived of going home for the holidays and being in contact with their families, and he saw saw that in them. He understood that this was a sacrifice. I mean, it was a privilege because they were among the elite of their country. It was a great honor to serve the Pope and protect the Pope, but that it also came with sacrifice. And so he was like a father to them, a father figure. And he, I think he took particular care in paying attention to these men and challenging them not only to be in Rome for their year or years of service as soldiers, but yeah. also that this was a time to sharpen their spiritual life. And so he challenged them in that way, but he was also there as like a father figure for them.
We've been going over some of the things that might surprise people. Let's go to those top 10, though, that you have. Number 10, he renewed devotion to the Blessed Mother.
Yeah, I mean, he totus tuus was his motto, not only as Pope, but it was his motto as a bishop. He became a bishop in 1958, and he took that as his motto. He lost his mother. She died when he was about nine years old. Mm-hmm. And it left a wound in him, a hole. And his father said to him, now Our Lady is your mother. And I think it was like our Lord giving Mary to St. John at the foot of the cross. It was like John Paul's father saying, here is your mother.
Yeah.
And he had a great devotion to Mary, as most people that study him know. And he wrote an encyclical on Mary in 1987 and declared a Marian year in 1987 as well. And a letter on the rosary, again in my top 10, is the Luminous Mysteries, which he presented to the church as, he didn't impose this on the church. He said, it seems to me that there's a gap here. And mm-hmm. then he wrote this letter and he said, what do you think? And the faithful just took it and ran with it.
Yeah, yeah. I thought the addition of the Luminous Mysteries was great. Mm-hmm. I've said before, and many others have too, that he and Cardinal Ratzinger really worked hard to give a proper understanding to the Second Vatican Council. And I notice you have that in your top 10 as well. Tell me a little bit more.
Yeah, no question. You know, there was a lot of confusion during and after the council. I think Paul VI was kind of overwhelmed with the response, and it was not unpacked well. It came in the midst
right.
of a global revolution, sexual revolution, the change in society. Everything was changing so rapidly in the culture and society that it was a very difficult time to present change in the church as well, even though the change was necessary and overdue. So John Paul was one of the youngest bishops at the beginning of the council in 1962, but by the end of the council, he was one of the bishops who had made the greatest impact on the council and his teachings. And as he began his papacy, just a few years after the council ended, he really saw that as his job to unpack the council. So in virtually every talk that he gave and every document that he wrote, he referred back to the council in a way that would say, this is part of what the council fathers intended for the church.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that was also the impetus then behind the catechism.
Yes, yes. So the catechism came out of an ecumenical council that marked, I think it was the 10th anniversary of the end of the council, might have been the 15th, 1980 or so, so maybe the 12th. So, but it was one of the recommendations of a synod of bishops that recommended a new universal catechism. There hadn't been one since the Council of Trent.
Yeah.
And so that was the Roman Catechism, and a lot of the critics said, well, that's it's old-fashioned, we don't need a catechism.
Right.
But John Paul pursued it very vigorously, put Cardinal Ratzinger in charge. By the way, Cardinal Ratzinger will turn 93 tomorrow.
Ooh.
So keep him in your prayers.
Yeah.
And the catechism was published in 1992. It became a worldwide bestseller to the critics' chagrin, and is one of the most influential, even one of the best-selling Catholic books even today in the year 2020, decades after it was first published.
Well, I remember a theological advisor to a major diocese in the United States telling me I was new to the church at that time. I came into full communion in 1992. So there was all talk about the catechism, and then in English, I think it was 1994 that we got it. But I can remember this theological advisor for a particular diocese telling me that, well, you know, it's no big thing. I'm not sure that we even need a catechism. So there definitely were people in operation, even in high places in dioceses, who didn't think the catechism was a good idea. We've got about 2 minutes left, and I must get you to the theology of the body, number three on your list.
Yeah, theology of the body. George Weigel said that it's like a theological time bomb that's set to go off sometime after John Paul II leaves the stage. I mean, first major teaching of John Paul's pontificate was theology of the body. It kind of grew out of his experience as a priest in Poland, his book Love and Responsibility, published in 1960, kind of thing. And it's so timely because there's so much confusion around sexuality in the church, in the culture, I should say. Very important teaching. But let me also emphasize divine mercy, because he had a huge hand in authenticating the message that Jesus gave Faustina in the 1930s during her vision. We're coming up on Mercy Sunday. I was actually in St. Peter's Square at Faustina's canonization when he said the second Sunday of Easter shall henceforth be known as Divine Mercy Sunday.
Yeah.
So huge, hugely important. And
number one.
Number one is the new evangelization.
Yeah.
And simply because this, Paul VI said the church exists to evangelize. John Paul saw that, you know, the church needs to be bringing the message of Jesus Christ, the great commission that Jesus gave his disciples when he ascended into heaven. That is the prime mission of the church, to bring people into right relationship with Jesus Christ. So all of this stuff that John Paul did was geared toward the new evangelization, whether it was World Youth Day, Theology of the Body, the Rosary, Devotion to Mary, all of that points to Jesus Christ.
Yeah. What a fruitful life. You know, this was a man of great consequence. And thank you for this book. Is it published yet?
Yes, it's available on Kindle right now. Look for 100 Ways John Paul II Changed the World. The paperback will be out in October in time for John Paul's feast day, October 22nd.
All right. 100 Ways John Paul II Changed the World, Patrick Nowakowski. Patrick, great talking with you again. Thanks.